We're about to hear the story of a very famous tune from the 1940s, a story told to Gene Lees by bandleader Les Brown and vocalist Doris Day years later, and published by Gene Lees in 1996 in his Jazz Letter, and shared here on Lees' site, Swingin' Beyond, that's curated by Michael Zerpolo. And here we go.
Gonna take a sentimental journey.
The story of Sentimental Journey is one that involves a great band, a skillful, perceptive, and smart band leader, and a beautiful young woman who could sing well and perfect timing. Les begins telling the tale. Arranger Ben Homer and I wrote Sentimental Journey together. It's hard to get people to believe that, because in those days, bandleaders were putting their names on material they did not write. I was offered so many songs, I never would put my name on anything unless I actually had something to do with writing the song. In this case, Ben called me and said, I'm up at Buddy Morris's office. Now, Buddy Morris was a music publisher. The Morris office was in the Brill Building on Broadway and West 49th in Midtown Manhattan, where many music publishers had offices. Les said, I found out later that Homer was trying to get an advance from Buddy, but Buddy was too smart. He said, I know you're a crook. Get in there and write me a tune. You're not getting any money from me unless you give me a tune. Homer told me one time that his philosophy was get the other guy before he gets you. And I told him, Ben, that's a terrible way to live. Homer was going to publishers all over town saying, you can't get on the air unless you pay me. I'm Les Brown's arranger. I make the arrangements. I tell him what to do. Les continued, I was living at the Whitby then when Homer called. He said, I've got a pretty good idea for a tune. Why don't you come up and we'll write it together? I've got the front part, but I can't think of a release. Les said, I had nothing to do, so I went to the Brill Building and I went to the piano and played a variant on the front strain that Homer had written. In that first version, the cell of the tune, the first two notes drop a sixth. This would increase the range, limiting the number of singers who would be able to handle it. So I pulled this fragment down to a major third, and that repeating pattern is the material of the front strain as the tune was finally published. Les continued. Then Homer said, well, what do we do about the release? I said, we'll do the Sears and Roebuck changes, which is a four chord to a one chord to a two chord to a five chord. Les played it. We wrote it in a few minutes. I think I had as much to do with the song as he did. In the meantime, said Les, my band wasn't recording. This was during the Musicians Union recording ban, wreaking further havoc on the American music business in the wake of the 1941 ASCAP radio strike. James Caesar Petrillo, president of the American Federation of Musicians, had barred all recording by union members starting on August 1, 1942. The dispute was finally settled with the union getting a royalty on records to be paid by the record companies into a union trust fund. Petrillo's argument was that recordings were putting musicians out of business, but nothing did more to put big bands out of business than that strike, which enabled the ascent in popularity of singers as stars, Frank Sinatra, Joe Stafford, Peggy Lee, Perry Como, and Nat Cole among them. Meanwhile, the as-yet-unnamed Les Brown Ben Homer melody was gathering dust in the office of music publisher Buddy Morris. Les said, two or three guys wrote lyrics on the tune, but Buddy Morris didn't like them. Then I got a call from Buddy, who said, I finally got a good lyric. It's called Sentimental Journey. I said, that's good. Where'd you get that? He said, I'm reading a book. It's a Baedeker of the 18th century called Sentimental Journey, A Guide to the Great Inns of Europe. I got Bud Green to write a lyric. Bud Green wrote the lyrics to I'll Get By and Once in a While and also Flatfoot Floogie. I went to Buddy's office and heard the lyric and said, great. I then directed Ben Homer to make an arrangement. I said, Ben, I want this in thirds. Clarinet above the subtone tenor lead, clarinets below. I'd used that combination in a lot of my own arrangements, and I liked that sound. Ben came in, probably to a rehearsal, and it was that. Les sang a blatant, loud figure. I said, stop the band. I told you what I want. Change the first 16 bars, or we don't record the thing.
Gonna take a sentimental
Doris Day later remembered, we were working at the Pennsylvania Hotel in New York. We'd rehearse after work when all the people were out of the dining room. That song suddenly appeared. Les handed me the lead sheet. I thought, this is really good. The very next night, we had a remote broadcast out of the pen at about 11:30. I sang Sentimental Journey, and bang, right off the bat, I started getting mail about it.
I could afford, like a child in wild anticipation, long to hear that all.
Les then added, people would come up and ask me about it. It's a simple song, simple as H-E-double-L. So we stopped playing it for a while because we were afraid somebody would steal it before we could record it. Finally, the recording ban ended in November of 1944, and we went in and recorded it. Clyde Stumpy Brown, who by then was playing trombone in his brother Les's band, remembered that the band was playing a job in Boston and took a night train to New York to record the song at Liederkranz Hall the next morning. Columbia put it out in January of 1945, Les said. It was just after the Battle of the Bulge. When that was won, we knew the war in Europe was over. It was perfect timing. If we'd brought it out earlier, I don't know whether it would have been a hit. Psychologically, it was perfect timing. I've had so many GIs come up and say something like, hey, I was on a boat docking in New York and it was our favorite song because we were going home. It might not have been a hit if it had not been for the record ban, which delayed its release until then. The tune reached the top of the popularity charts, the hit so big for Doris Day, as well as the band, that it became almost a theme song for her. Sentimental Journey did indeed make Doris Day a star, and so striking were her looks and her wholesome charm that the movie industry was, by the autumn of 1946, beckoning. But that was not the immediate reason she left the band. Les said she was getting $500 a week through 44, 45, and part of 46. That's equivalent to $5,000 or $10,000 now. She got so far ahead, she wasn't spending the money. She married one of my saxophone players, George Wheedler, and they decided they didn't want to go on the road anymore. I understood that because I didn't want to go either, but I had to. Accompanying this article in Swing and Beyond, in fact, is a unique snapshot of Doris Day taken by a fan on the morning of Friday, October 11th, 1946, in Tamaqua, Pennsylvania, the night before was her last as Les Brown's vocalist. The Brown Band had played a dance at Lakewood Park, Barnesville, PA. And now to the song itself. Lees writes, the performance starts with no introduction, just a simple exposition of the main melody by the saxophones, with cup-muted trumpets and open trombones behind them. The entire band begins the secondary bridge melody, then the various sections play. Thank you. Note that in the mass of brass in this sequence, we hear a clarinet in the sonic mix. I suspect that was played by Les Brown. A modulation follows, at first bright and powerful, then much quieter.
Like a child in wild anticipation, long to hear that all.
The second chorus belongs to Doris Day, and we can hear what a fine singer she was. She had good voice quality, an excellent sense of pitch and easy swing, and good range. In addition, she had what the French call je ne sais quoi, which means literally, I don't know what, but connotatively means a pleasant quality that cannot be named or described. Notice how she subtly adds a bit of spice to the words, like a child in wide anticipation, long to hear that all aboard. That is what was called selling the song during the swing era, and she does it quite well. Also listening for the infinitesimal squeak or rasp that she has in her voice in various places throughout her singing on this recording. It is inexplicably attractive. The contrasting tenor saxophone obbligato behind her singing was played by Ted Nash. And the rest is history. As we heard, the story that was told by Les and Doris about the creation of Sentimental Journey includes a photo of Doris Day taken by a fan on the morning of October 11, 1946 in Tamaqua. The night before was her last as Les Brown's vocalist. The Brown Band had played a dance at Lakewood Park in Barnesville. Ah, now we're getting closer to home. Earlier, Les Brown mentioned that he was living at the Whitby on West 45th Street in New York, where other tenants included Glenn and Helen Miller, Benny Goodman, Bud Freeman, Jimmy McPartland, Gene and Ethel Krupa, Gil Evans, Doris Day, and yes, Les and Claire Brown. But Brown was born at the corner of East Grand Avenue and 2nd Street in Reinerton, Pennsylvania, in Schuylkill County, on March 14, 1912. And though he had a national and international career with his band that came to be the Band of Renown, leading the band on the Dean Martin Show, The Tonight Show starring Steve Allen, and then the Steve Allen Show itself, and Brown and the band traveling the world with Bob Hope for his Christmas shows from 1961 through 1973, and so much more. But Les Brown never forgot his roots in Schuylkill County, and his family and friends have never forgotten him. We're invited to a celebration this weekend in Schuylkill County. It's the 18th annual Les Brown Big Band Weekend, taking place April 9th, 10th, and 11th, with a film festival, a USO-themed dance, and a concert featuring six bands performing nonstop with special guest Hal Espinosa, longtime Band of Renown member, and much more. We had a chance to speak by phone with David Minnick, cousin of Les Brown, founding committee member and patron of the festival, and Joel Goulden, prominent music educator and band director in the Williams Valley School District, organizer and committee chair for the annual Les Brown Big Band Weekend. And we begin with David's family memories.
He was born in Schuylkill County in the small village of Reinerton, which is just east of Tower City. Tower City is the very west end of Schuylkill County. It borders up against Dauphin County. And my grandmother, Edna Brown Carl, was a sister to Ray Brown. And Ray Brown, or as we knew him around the area, R.W., Raymond Winfield, of course, was Les's dad. When Les and Hattie got married, they didn't have a place to move into of their own, so they went housekeeping at my grandmother's home. Now, my grandfather was a stonemason, and he built the home in Reinerton. The home he built was kind of a modern home compared to the rest of the homes in the area, as I understand it. There were four floors, and he deeded the land from Charlemagne Tower, who was the founder of Tower City, in 1908. And from what I understand, he was a pretty smart cookie, my grandfather. He passed away when my mother was only 10 years old, leaving eight children for my grandmother to raise. The youngest was only two, and the oldest was probably around 14 or 15, so there were eight of them all together. And there was a rather large basement room in the home, and that's where Aunt Hattie and Uncle Ray lived, and that's how Les came to be born in their home. And a side story of that is my grandmother had just had a baby a few months before Les was born, and she was still nursing Lynn, her son. And for some reason, Aunt Hattie couldn't nurse right away when Les was born. So our grandmother gave Les his first couple meals, as we understand it. So there was always those tight bonds back in those days.
Was Uncle Ray involved in music, David?
Very much so. Back in the day in that valley, Tower City sits as a hub. It's a borough, and it's surrounded by Porter Township, which is five small communities, villages. All these little communities back in the day had their own community band, if you will. No TV back in those days, and you got other modes of entertainment, and there were lots of bands and band competitions and church festivals and strawberry festivals that these bands played at. And R.W. played in numerous bands. He played clarinet, but he also played violin for a while, as I understand it. And he was in Higgins playing at a Sunday school event, playing violin, and that's where he met Hattie Nye. That's how they got hooked up. And as they say, the rest is history. But that's how Les came to be born in my grandmother's living room. And somewhere around 2002 or three, my sister came up with the idea of putting a historical marker in front of grandmother's house. Now, of course, my grandmother is long gone. She passed away in 1961. So she got an application, but she was working at the time. I retired after 34 years of state work for the Commonwealth, working for the National Guard in 04. So I had some free time, and I got this application. She passed that on to me and said, here, you take care of this. So being the big sister, I, of course, obeyed. And turned out to be quite an arduous job. There was more to just filling out the paperwork. Once the application was off to the Pennsylvania Historical Society, when they were considering it, I got information from them and found I had to get, of course, permission from the Green family, who owned the property now where my grandmother lived. And, of course, we had to supply information from the township, getting permits from them. They would do the actual installation of this historical marker, and we had to get all that lined up, and I had to get an organization to support the whole episode in that area. So when I lived in Tower City, I was a Rotarian. So I contacted the Tower Porter Rotary Club, and they voted and agreed to sponsor this historical mark. So once I had all that established, then I had to raise some money. So I contacted every cousin, my brother, my sister, and said, this is what we're doing at Grandma's house. How about a couple bucks? So I had cousins from California send money, and cousins from Elizabethtown sending money, and a cousin from Elizabethtown owned a print shop, actually, in Harrisburg area, and he printed up all the programs, and it just mushroomed from there, and I think I raised a couple thousand dollars, and we got that lined up, and then the historical marker was voted on by the Pennsylvania Historical Society, and they said yes, that we would be able to get a marker. And then I had to sit down with the committee and come up with a text for the sign, which we recognized the fact that he worked for the Dean Martin Show and Bob Hope and Doris Day, all those highlights. And that's basically what the sign says out front of Grandmother's House. And while I was working on all of this back in 2004, I took a little vacation to friends who were living in Florida. And while I was there, I just on a whim called Stumpy Brown, which I did occasionally, and just checked in to see how he was doing. And he said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm down in Florida in North Fort Myers." Oh, he said, "Les is down at, I think it was Fort Lauderdale, with the band." He said, "I'll get you tickets to go to his concert." So he did. And at intermission, I went backstage and introduced myself and told Les Jr. what we were doing with the historical marker out in front of Grandma's house. He said, "You let me know who, what, when, and where this is going on." And he said, "I'll be there to help with the dedication." So I told him what was going on, and he said, "How about we make it for April the 14th, which is my dad's birthday?" I said, "Well, we can do that." And that's what we did. Once the marker was done and ready to be put in front of Grandma's house, the township did the installation, and we planned it for April the 14th, and Les flew in, and cousins flew in from California. Les Sr. had a brother, Stumpy. He came in later years. But he also had a brother, Warren. Warren had two children. The one child flew in from California. And Sylvia was a sister to Les Sr. Sylvia's daughter, Barbara, came in. So there was an influx of Browns and Quarles and Minnicks, and the whole gang got together. And I mean, it was a funny situation. We grandkids got together in Grandma's house, and all of a sudden, oh my God, this house is so much smaller than we remembered as children. Of course, it was Grandma's house is always big. Of course, we were little back then. So it was a blistery day, warm here in 2006. It was warm the day before the dedication, and then we had another cold snap, and Les had flown in from Missouri. And he did not have a winter coat. He just had a sports coat. And he almost froze to death because we had the dedication, of course, out front. And we were all on Grandma's, what would have been her front porch. And that was the stage part, if you will. And we had East Grand Avenue, Route 209, blocked off for a couple of squares. And people were standing on the street. And there were a couple of hundred people. And I had the Tremont Community Band there. Back in the day, R.W. had written a march called The Pride of Tower City. Never went into print, but there are some handwritten pieces around that I have, actually. The Tremont Community Band was under direction of Rod Lookinbill, a good friend of mine. We serve on the board of the American Federation of Musicians together, and they have a copy of The Pride of Tower City. So, of course, that was the main request, and they played prior to the dedication. And after we did all the recognitions, and the politicians were there with proclamations, and the mayor was there with proclamations, mayor of Tower City, Dale Dieter. And after all that bit was done, and Les crawled up a ladder and took the cover off of the historical marker, and Tremont Band started up with the Pride of Tower City, and we had a benediction, and then from there we went down to Williams Valley School cafeteria, and we had people of the community that had signed up. We had almost 250 people signed up for a dinner and a dance, and this was done in coordination with Rotary, and all the funding went through Rotary, and then they paid the bills, and we put on a nice meal. And that's how Mr. Goulden got involved.
That's a perfect segue. You arrived just at the right time, Joel, because David was telling us about the dedication of the marker. And he said, and that's where Mr. Goulden came in.
So Joel got a hold of me and said, is there some place that my jazz band could be a part of this dedication? He was directing at the elementary school at Williams Valley at the time. I said, well, we're going to be at the high school in the cafeteria, and I have a band performing there after we're eating. I said, but how about the jazz band play while we're eating? So he agreed to that. And then he asked if the senior jazz band could play also. So they also performed while we were eating. And then we had a dinner dance following the meal that really these 250, 300 people were a part of. It's pretty much the history. And that's 20 years ago now.
And Joel, what were you thinking in terms of your teaching? You were teaching your students about this era and to play these charts and so forth. Was that part of your strategy as a music teacher?
Well, we had been, yes. I had been exposing them to that. And I knew that Les Brown was a part of, had some history there in the Valley, but nothing had ever been done when I brought this up, you know, except for David bringing this up. And it was a good opportunity, I felt, there to expose the students to who he was. And that's really, that dedication got the whole ball rolling.
I don't want to lose the educational thread because we know Les went off to Duke and he was in the Duke Blue Devils. So he got a foundation, not just in the Valley, but when he went off to college in bands under the auspices of schools and education. Do you have a sense that that was important to him?
Oh, I think it was, yeah. Duke gave him that great opportunity to organize a band because he had the musicians there. And then, of course, they were the first band, I think the first college band ever affiliated with a college to actually get a recording contract. And that was with Decca back that time on 78th. And they were the first college band, like I say, to cut a record on a major label.
If you go back and listen, if they're available, those Decca Blue Devil records, can you hear something less brownish about them?
That's a hard call. You know, that was a completely different type of jazz back then. It was actually before swing started in. So you have more of that 30s type jazz sound. It was smaller instrumentation. It wasn't the full instrumentation of the saxophone and the trumpet section with rhythm. They were a smaller group. But some of the guys, his drummer remained with him for years and years. Actually became his road manager until he retired and Stubby took over. But he had a legacy of treating the guys very well, as opposed to some directors. He really did. And that's why he had guys that were with him for, you know, 50, 60 years.
How did he get from the East Coast to the West Coast?
Well, actually, the Duke Band ended up, I think their last gig was in Jersey, and then they kind of disbanded because a lot of the guys wanted to go back and finish their education and graduate, which not many people know that Les actually never got a degree from Duke because he decided to go off and, you know, pursue music. There was maybe a year, year and a half where he had no band at all, and he was doing arrangements, I believe, in New York City for other bands. And then somebody suggested that he started his own, and he did. He started up the Les Brown Orchestra, which will actually, if you go to see the movie that we have on Thursday, that Thursday night, we'll be showing one of the few movies, well, the only movie that has Les Brown's orchestra in it before they became known as the Band of Renown. So that gives you kind of a glimpse of his early band.
One of the things we do know is that he really connected with the people on the West Coast, and he became the house band, as you were saying, David, that's on the marker. You know, he became associated with, as you mentioned, Dean Martin and Bob Hope, certainly. He must have been a good guy because these people really loved him and respected him, Bob Hope, for example.
And he was also the house band for The Tonight Show before Johnny Carson, Steve Allen.
Joel, what would make him a good house band in terms of his style and so forth?
Yeah, you know, most of the time you think of, especially with, you know, so much with Johnny Carson Show and Doc Severns and his out front there and his outlandish outfits. And actually, Les was a lot more subdued than that. And just recently, I've been trying to explore more of the Dean Martin stuff that he did and the Steve Allen Tonight Show stuff, which if you sit back and listen, I mean, most of the times, the arrangements that they are playing really boost what the performer is singing. And sometimes people get so caught up in the performer's excellence, you don't really even notice what's really keeping it all together, and that's the arrangements. And some of those arrangements, like I say, really, really fantastic.
You surely know that the arranger is an unsung hero sometimes. And did I read that so many of Les's charts are at Duke in the archives?
Yes, that's right. I had the opportunity many years ago to go down there, and they have it in their rare books room, but they're freely open to go down in there and inspect. And kind of a neat thing is to look at the scores and the music and see the notations that a lot of the players have put on there, the little comments they've written, and heads up, look at this, or, oh, this chart is not as good as I thought it was going to be. You know, different things like that. It kind of gives you some insight.
What do you say, Joel, when you're talking about the big bands and the various sounds and so forth, and some that are really jazzy and some that don't swing as much? Where does Les Brown's sound come in generally?
Well, I feel Les has really been not seen that much. He's been seen as a band is kind of played along, you know, and backed up Bob Hope. That's what we mostly know it as. However, if you listen to his stuff and the musicians that he had in there, some of these guys are unbelievable. A lot of these guys, unbelievable improvisers. People think, oh, swing, that's not jazz. No, there's a fine line there where you can just have plain swing, but then some of the rides that these guys take, unbelievable. And when we're talking about unsung heroes, you had said before about the arrangers. Yeah, one of the guys that we honored last year, Jay Hill, was Les's arranger starting in the late 60s. Through the 70s and 80s, and he did a lot of other stuff. But he and Van Alexander had done a lot of the arrangements for the Dean Martin show, and you'll see that. And Les did a few also. But those guys, and we're fortunate to have Jay still with us. I think Jay is now 92 or 93, and I do have contact with him. But, you know, his stuff is just, it's amazing. And the nice thing with Jay was he actually started out, I think, with Les's band when they were the house band for The Tonight Show. And he was a trombone player. And he played up on trombone with them and then started arranging and kept arranging more and more. So he just eventually dropped out as a trombonist and just arranged for them. So, yeah, he knew exactly the sound that Les wanted and was able to complement that.
We know about, and some people remember, the Bob Hope specials. Did Les travel with Bob when he went overseas?
Yeah, he started actually when Bob was over in World War II. That was another band that was playing with him. But once Korea came around, he started with Bob. It was with Bob's radio show. Bob picked him up on that. And I think Desi Arnaz was the house band at that time. And Bob preferred Les's sound. So he picked up him for the radio show. And then, of course, once the Korean conflict opened up, it was just natural with Bob going over. Having done USO shows for World War II, he was going to do it for the Korean conflict and took Les and the band along. And, of course, kept it right through the Cold War up through Vietnam.
You all have made a point in these festivals of recognizing the importance of Les and the Band of Renown in terms of the veterans and those who were in the various conflicts, wars, and so forth, that music like Sentimental Journey and things like that defined an era in terms of people longing to come home, longing to have the wars over. Is that fair to say?
Yes. You know, a few years ago, before COVID, we actually did a USO show and had a Bob Hope impersonator there, tried to recreate. David and I talked it over and thought, you know what? How about for the dance? And this was inspired by other dances that I was at. Let's turn this into a USO dance. So the Friday night dance now is going to be a USO dance. We're trying to get the word out to VFWs and Legions that any Korean, Cold War, or Vietnam veterans, I mean, all veterans are welcome, but we're especially those guys, since they were the guys that the Band of Renown entertained. We have free admission for those men and women that served during that time. And hopefully we'll get a good response there.
And the band that you have invited to make that dance music is apparently a great one. Tell us who's going to be playing for the dance.
Well, that's the Unforgettable Big Band of York. I just saw those. I went to a dance about a month ago, and they're vocalists now. They have two, I believe they're sisters that are vocalists, and are actually doing Andrew's sister's songs, just the two of them. But the way they sing, you don't miss that third part. It's kind of neat. It's not the typical male or female vocalist that a lot of these big bands have. They have, like I say, these two young ladies that are doing the Andrews Sisters type thing, which is, it's more World War II, but that's all right. We'll take it.
Tell us about your special guest.
Well, this year we're saluting Hal Espinosa, who was a trumpet player during the 60s and 70s, and Jack Redman, who was trombonist in late 60s all the way up until the Band of Renown moved to Branson. Jack, unfortunately, will not be joining us. He is just this month, he's turning 91, and he's in great shape. Actually, he just retired from playing in the fall. But his wife is having some health problems, so he said he's got to stay in L.A. with her. We had Jack come in, I think, three times? He came in as our guest.
Yep, three times, I think.
And Hal has been here once. Hal, we're a little more fortunate. He lives in Annapolis, Maryland, so he'll be driving up, and you can't make it for the Friday dance, but he will be here for Saturday. He's a former lead trumpet player with the Band Renown and played with them through the 60s into the early 70s and then retired from playing trumpet once he became the president of the Musicians Union of L.A., which took up so much of his time.
It's always wonderful to have those people who were part of it, who were in the middle of it all. Tell us then, we know about the dance and we know about the film. Tell us about Saturday.
Well, on Saturday, hopefully returning to what we had years ago before COVID, we've got, I think, about six bands coming, the majority of which are school bands, which is always fun to hear their music, up-and-coming musicians. The one band that we will have to actually just form this year, others jazz bands that have been playing for quite a few years in their school curriculum. We also are fortunate to have the Elizabethtown College Band returning. They had been with us quite a few years ago, but they'll be coming back. So it's nice to have a college band. And then our big featured band will be the Moonlighters out of Lititz.
And I know, Joel, you were always a very clever educator because you would get your students to learn the facts and historical things by giving them quizzes and having them have some fun with the facts.
Well, actually, what I did was I was very fortunate to have cooperation with our third grade teachers. They would let me come in for about 20 minutes to each classroom each week and do a mini Band of Renown lesson, which I did from the beginning of school till the end. So we had students coming out of there that could run rings around the average person as far as knowing songs and how the origin and who was in the band and all this kind of different facts, you know. So, yeah, we thought it was very important that the students should know this, not just, oh, there's a festival, and not know who this guy is, what this band is, because it's a part of their area history.
One question for you, Joel, and one for you, David. Joel, you look back and you've been playing and listening for all these years and teaching music and so forth. What are the things that might be considered the legacy of Les Brown?
What I always stress as an educator to our students was not just the musical legacy that he left, but a legacy for them to apply to themselves. And that's in no matter what they do. I've said this tons of times, that they might think, oh, I'm from this little town in the middle of nowhere. What can I ever do? And we tried to stress that, look what this guy did. You could do whatever you want. You know, don't think just because you're not from the big city that you can't make your dreams come true.
Oh, that's critical. And David, I wanted to just ask you, what sense do you have as Les was out there and going overseas with Bob Hope and doing all the recordings and so forth? Back home, were people watching those shows? Were people excited to know he's from our place? Was he a presence even though he was on the road and making his music? Was he really part of the valley and around there?
He was. I mean, of course, every time he was on TV, you were glued to the set. The relative part of it was. And we always watched when he was abroad. But every time he came home, my mother and I would go and visit while Les was there. And I know at one point there were less and less doctors in the area. And the JC Town group got together and wanted to get a health organization and building together somewhere around Williams Valley. And Les came back to Williams Valley with the Band of Renown to the high school and performed a free concert as a moneymaker to get this health building set up for Williams Valley. And that was a huge event. I think it was only one concert. But Les did things like that in the valley, and he stayed later years when he would come back. He would stay with friends in Lycans, I know, that he grew up with as a young boy and had lifelong friends in Lycans. I know he stayed there a couple times when he came back home. And I know he also, when the last place that R.W. and Hattie lived was the Tremont Nursing Home when their health was really declining. And Les, I can say I played under Les Brown because we got a little group together, that the Umpah band kind of thing. And Les just stood in front of us and directed. But we played out at the nursing home when Les came to visit there, when his parents were residents at the Tremont. So, I mean, he came back there, of course, then for their funerals. They were buried in the area. He came back for that. Not all of them. Stumpy could never come back for the funeral, but he did come back to town. I was able to get Stumpy down to the cemetery where his parents are buried. He had never seen his own parents' cemetery plot. So Les was a big man musically, but as Junior always used to say, he never forgot his roots. He always remembered the Tower City and Pennsylvania area.
David Minnick, cousin of Les Brown, a founding committee member and patron of the Les Brown Big Band Festival Weekend, and Joel Goulden, prominent music educator and band director in the Williams Valley School District, organizer and committee chair for the annual Les Brown Big Band Weekend, which will be held this weekend. And it is a three-day affair, April 9th, 10th, and 11th. The festival gets underway with a film event, and that's Thursday, April 9th at 7 o'clock, and that's at the historic Pine Grove Theater, and that's on South Pulpahawken Street in Pine Grove. Admission is free, and the festival features a film that Les and the Band of Renown appeared in, and it's from 1942, and that's an exciting opportunity, rarely seen gem. And then Friday, April 10th at 7, it's the Les Brown USO Dance. And that's at the Wiskanisco Fire Hall in Wiskanisco, Pennsylvania on Arch Street, featuring the music of the unforgettable big band of York, Pennsylvania. The dance is reminiscent of the years the Band of Renown played for Bob Hope's USO shows in Korea and Vietnam. And to honor this, all attending veterans of those wars and their partners receive free admission. And as we say, the dance will be held in the Wiskanisco Fire Hall on Arch Street. And the area is wonderful. It's comfortable. 120 people can be accommodated and plenty of room for dancing. Refreshments are available for purchase, and that's not to be missed. And if you'd like to dress in any of your armed forces attire, that would be fun, too. Then the Les Brown Big Band Festival Saturday Extravaganza, April 11th at 5 p.m. with a six-band roster. And the special guest will be Hal Espinoza, retired first trumpet for the Band of Renown. Jack Redman will be remembered. He's a trombonist. He's fine, but he's out on the West Coast and won't be making the trip. But the Saturday Extravaganza concert, Williams Valley High School, Route 209 in Tower City, featuring the music of the Moonlighters from Lititz, and as we heard, the Elizabethtown College Jazz Band, the Northwestern Lehigh Jazz Band, the Millersburg High School Jazz Band, North Schuylkill High School Jazz Band, Williams Valley Cool Blue Jazz Band, and the Town of Renown Orchestra. And that's all part of the wonderful annual festival to keep the memory of Les Brown alive in his home county, Schuylkill County. And if you need more information, you can go to the website, which is lesbrownfest.org, DukeBest.org. And in the interest of full disclosure, in 2017, these wonderful folks invited me to be the MC of the multi-band concert evening, and was such great fun. We had wonderful fun. And so they've invited me back. And so I'll be honored to be the host on Saturday at Williams Valley High School for the 6-band extravaganza, and we'll have a chance to talk with Hal Espinosa. We'll do an interview with him. There'll be a trivia contest and lots of fun. And that's the Williams Valley High School, Tower City, Route 209. And for more information on the entire festival, the free film on April 9th at the Pine Grove Historic Theater, that will be at 7 in the evening. And all the rest, the wonderful USO Big Band Dance, LesBrownFest.org.